It was the third hour when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, They crucified the king of the Jews. They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from your cross and save yourself. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross, that we may see and believe. Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing near this, they said, Listen, he's calling Elijah. One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now, leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down, he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus heard his cry and saw how he died, he said, Surely this man was the Son of God. Dominic?
Hey, look, thanks very much, Russell, and good afternoon. It's nice to see you here at the City Bible Forum this afternoon. And can I just say, as we get underway for this Easter week presentation from City Bible Forum, today is going to be confronting. In the year or so that I've been involved here in the City Bible Forum, today is the most confronting day that I've been involved with, and it is because of the subject material of Easter, of death, that it is by nature confronting. So hold on to your seatbelts, because here we go. We're getting our heads in gear for Easter. A few years ago in Sydney, a woman was murdered. Her name was Anita Cobby, nurse, brutal gang rape attack. And some of us here will have vivid memories of that. Who here remembers the whole Anita Cobby case? I mean, reasonably vivid. For me, it was a vivid memory. I was working in the newsroom that on the evening that the rapists were arrested, and I remember the struggle as we related with Blacktown Police to cover the arrest of these men. For others, it will be a very vague memory. Who's heard the name, but not much more? And then for others, you'll be thinking, Anita who? And it's only 15 years ago, and it was the biggest news story in Sydney that year. Or you go back 10 years to the stabbing murder by O.J. Simpson of his wife, and some of us have a very vivid memory of that news story, and it was described in 1997 as the news event of the decade. And yet for some of us it'll be only a vague memory, and some of us it'll be O.J. who? Or 2006, December 2006, this is the execution of Saddam Hussein. It's confronting, isn't it? To see a man killed like that. Here it is again. On the gallows in Baghdad. And it's awful. It's shocking to look up close at death. And that's what we're going to do today. There's three deaths from our world these last few years, and they were big names in our news. Anita Cobby, O.J. Simpson, Saddam Hussein. But all of those killings, I mean, even the awful degradation that Anita Cobby went through at the hands of that Western Sydney hoodlum gang, none of them are as awful as the awful violence, the degradation, the horror of crucifixion. I think Russell's going to kill the lights for us, and I'll just take you to a little video of the crucifixion, the death of Judas, then who betrayed Jesus, and then the death of Jesus himself. It is confronting. Crucifixion is the most degrading form of punishment that in our perversity we humans have ever invented. It was the most wretched, the cruelest, the ugliest way to die. It was the customary form of execution in the first century. It was a brutal punishment invented to punish, but also to deter. So those being crucified would be led through the streets, having been beaten, having been whipped, having been gouged, carrying their cross, so that people could see what happened to a person who did what they had done. And the crucified one, I mean, often in the cross, you'd be strung up 6-7 foot off the ground because you'd only just need to be lifted off the ground. But sometimes they'd crucify very high to make a public spectacle, to make a public exhibition. And then the shudder that people felt over the cross as an instrument of execution, it led to people inventing this word, excruciating, because that word definition means an agonizingly long period of debilitating pain. And so it really kind of trivialises it to think, what have we done? Just talking to a bloke just a moment ago, arrived here, and he said, what we've done in the office to mark Easter is we've had hot cross buns. And we've got some hot cross buns to serve at the end of the City Bible Forum. But it kind of trivialises it that this morning my kids have been part of the Easter bunny parade at school and the Easter hat parade, and there's Easter eggs and bunnies, and the great debate in Annandale School is whether or not the Easter bunny exists, and the school has taught them that the Easter bunny is fact and that Jesus is fiction. And the name Anita Cobby is starting to drift off out of our consciousness. And O.J. Simpson, my friend Malcolm, he named his son Oliver Jack Williams the same week that O.J. Simpson went to trial. And I said, why are you calling him O.J.? And he said, by the time he's 10, that name will be a distant memory. That name won't be part of the public debate. And, I mean, it's only going to be a few decades, could be 100 years, but Saddam Hussein will have gone from the public memory. But why Jesus? Why Jesus and his death? Why is it different? Why is it a news event that stands in the public? I ask my kids to tell me about O.J. Simpson. They'll look at me blankly. I ask them to talk to me about Anita Cobby. They'll look at me blankly. But Jesus, he has a lasting significance with a real relevance to us. Why does Jesus, his death, why is Easter relevant to us? Well, there are some similarities between what happened to Jesus, what happened to O.J. Simpson. I think we need some more lights on here, mate. We're still missing a switch. Thanks. What is the significance of Jesus to us? Well, I've got three questions I'm going to address today to say why I think Easter is still significant. One is who Jesus is. The other is what happened at Jesus' death. And what happened at Jesus' death between him and his father, and also what happened at Jesus' death between him and me. And so, firstly, who is Jesus? Well, Jesus was born 2,000 years ago, descendant of the Israelite patriarch Judah, and the Jews had spent years, centuries, longing for the coming of a Messiah, a king. And in the Jewish Old Testament Bible, there were predictions of God's Messiah King who would come, who would lead the Jews, who would deliver them from their oppressors. And all through Jesus' life, there'd been allusions to the fact that this man Jesus might be the longed-for Jewish Messiah. And at the time of his execution, the local Roman governor, who in our terms would have roughly the same status as the mayor of Parks, there's nobody here related to Mayor of Parks, is there? Yeah, no. He's a very unimportant man. And if you're on the web and you're listening to us and you are the Mayor of Parks, I'm sorry, but you're unimportant. That's the governor of Judea. That's Pontius Pilate. And what did Pontius Pilate do? He wrote a sign above the head of Jesus, and was the third hour when they crucified him, sentence 25 of Mark 15. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." And I think the governor, the local governor, was being sarcastic. He meant to say something like this: this brutal, humiliating, awful, degrading, excruciating death, this is what happens to people who set themselves up against, as rival kings against the great King Caesar, my boss in Rome. And Pilate, although he was speaking with pinpoint accuracy, was actually speaking sarcastically. Because it was pinpoint accurate, because if you look back through the Old Testament is scattered with predictions of a Messiah, a king, a ruler who would come. And Jesus fulfills those predictions to the letter that God would send a king. who would be a king after his own heart, who would live on the planet, who would rule the planet, who would be in total step with the heart of God. Now, it's just worth us stopping and seeing that we're people who are on God's planet, who are walking God's planet, but are not walking in total step with the heart of God. In that none of us passionately seek to do God's will at every point. Every one of us does a little bit of what I want, a little bit of what they want, a little bit of what... But the way I treat other people, the way I'm selfish, the way I look after myself, the way I deal with my money, none of us can say consistently, wholeheartedly, I live in a way that God would be pleased with. And even if I'd put aside God's standards and just run on my standards, I don't even make my standards. Oh, the standards that I've set for me, for my life. I mean, you've got standards that you've set for your life. And we don't achieve our own standards. I haven't got a hope of meeting God's standards. And so God, who is holy and God, who is perfect, he looks at me and says, "You're unacceptable to me." You say, well, what happened at Jesus' death then? Because at the death of Jesus, God's Son died. But if Jesus had always walked in step with his Father, if he'd always pleased his Father, why would he die? It doesn't make sense. If he's always lived God's way, he surely is the one who never should have died and certainly shouldn't have died this awful, excruciating, painful death. At the moment of the death of Jesus, Jesus was abandoned, not just by Judas, not just by his mates, the other disciples, not just by the soldiers who whipped him, who flogged him, who gouged him, who spat at him, who struck his face, but much more significant than that, and this is perhaps the key thing I'm going to say this afternoon, Jesus was abandoned by his Father. Here's how the Bible writer Mark puts it. At the sixth hour, darkness came over the whole land until the ninth hour. At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, centuries earlier, after God used Moses to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, God gave the Israelites instructions on how they, a sinful people, how they, a people who'd rebelled against him, could approach him, the holy God. And the instructions outlined by God in Leviticus 16, it was a ceremony where the people would come to God, they would confess their wrong before him, and would symbolically place their wrong onto the head of a goat. And then the goat would be sent out, sent away, sent out of the camp, away into the desert to bleed, to die. And the people were understanding that they were forgiven because a goat's blood had been shed in their place. And just as the goat was abandoned and died in the place of the Jews, so that God's anger could be turned aside, so we're to see that Jesus was abandoned by the Father so that God's anger could be turned aside. What was going on in God's heart, in the Father's heart? Because here we have the perfect Father, the ultimate Father. And I find this very hard to get my head around, because I'm a son who has a dad who loves me. And I love my dad, and my dad loves me, and I enjoy spending time with my dad, and I'm looking forward to having breakfast with him tomorrow. But I've not been the perfect son, and he's not been the perfect dad. And yet, were I in trouble, there's nothing that my father... I can't think of a thing that my father wouldn't do to get me out of trouble. And many of us will have relationships like that with our father. And yet here you have the perfect son, in perfect relationship with the perfect Father for all eternity from before time began. And right at this moment, the Father doesn't only not step in to rescue his son from the trouble, but sends his son to the trouble. There is awful pain in the crucifixion. This is the worst and most degrading form of death possible to imagine. But the real pain of the crucifixion is not the physical pain. The real pain of the crucifixion is the relational pain. Some of you will have been divorced. And every person I know, and at our church we're running a divorce care group, which is really helpful for people who've come, who are struggling and working through the divorce. And the word back that I'm getting from the people who are running it is there is so much pain that needs to be dealt with, that needs to be worked through. But that marriage, it was never a perfect marriage. I mean, it was never a perfect relationship. Not like the relationship between the Father and Son was perfect for all eternity. And here, that relationship, this is the ultimate relational pain. And God inflicted that pain on himself and on his Son for me. Jesus suffered it. So that I wouldn't, so that you wouldn't, so that we who are unacceptable to God would not have to be punished for eternity like we deserved. Now, Jesus' willingness to go to the cross doesn't lessen the horror of this pain. Significantly, this pain, it's not divine child abuse. There are some writers at the moment who are blasphemously describing this as divine child abuse. Jesus is not a child, and Jesus is not an unwilling victim. He willingly goes to his death. In fact, here at this moment of the death of Christ, you see the Father and the Son and the Spirit acting in perfect unity in the ultimate act of love, selfless love for me, for you. Well, that's what's happened in the relationship between Jesus and his Father at the moment of his death. What about what happened to the relationship between me and the Father at the moment of Jesus' death? And it is a very big surprise, I think, to read here in the middle of Mark's graphic account of the death of Jesus, a line that at first, for me, it appears to be a strange insertion. Read it with me. When some of those standing there heard this, "Listen," they said, "he's calling Elijah." One man ran, filled a sponge with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. I was first reading through this, and I got to this line about the curtain of the temple being torn in. Does that seem like a strange line to you to have it there? It seemed like a strange line to me, and I was reading through, and I thought about it like this in terms of listening to the radio. And I was listening to the radio on the way here and just imagining hearing on the 1 o'clock news. There's a riot here at the police holding cells at Sydney Police Centre. Inmates are rioting. They're kicking and punching at the officers. It's bedlam. Out at Parramatta, a flag has just been ripped in strong winds at Old Government House. One of the jail warders here at the Sydney Police Centre has called in the tactical response group officers. They'll shortly be moving in with batons. What's wrong with that news report? Not a rhetorical question. Somebody help me. Yeah. Flag. It's just totally out of place, isn't it? Just feels like the news reporter has been sitting there typing up the news and they've hit paste at the wrong moment, and they've pasted in a line from another news story, and it's just not supposed to be there. And that's what it feels like when you read through here. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down. We're all outside the Jerusalem, and we're just outside the city wall. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was suddenly, we're inside the temple in the middle of the city. And it's like Mark, who's been writing the gospel, was sitting there at his Mac, because he would have been using a Mac, because there was no Apple in the garden. It was an IBM that caused the problems. And so Mark is sitting there at his Apple Mac, and he's typing it out using OS X, and he's typing out, and he hits Apple paste and leaves this line in the Bible: the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and it's not supposed to be there, and it's sloppy sub-editing, and it's been sitting in the Bible for 2,000 years and no one's noticed till this afternoon. It is not sloppy sub-editing. It is theological gold. The Jews had the view that the temple was the place where you could approach God. But a Gentile, they could only come this far. And then this far, no further. In fact, there was a sign at this point in the temple, and it said, "If you're not a Jew and you go any further, your blood will be on your own head. You'll die." It's like, I used to go out, Mum and Dad, they took me out to the African Lion Safari out at Penrith. And driving into the African Lion Safari out at Penrith, you drive in there, and there was a sign saying, "Stay in the car, keep your window up, or you'll be eaten by lions." Do other people here remember that? Very strong motivation to keep the windows up. Well, you got to that point in the Jewish temple, and there was a sign saying, if you're not a Jew and you go beyond this point, not you'll be eaten by lions, but your blood will be on your own head. Then there was you could go a little bit further if you're a Jewish woman, a little bit further if you're a Jewish man, a little bit further if you're a priest, into the next. Each time there was a petition and a sign, and then there was this huge curtain. And only the Jewish high priest was allowed to go past that point, and only once a year. In fact, the regulation, he'd only go once a year because that was the time when he dealt with sin. And he had a surfboard rope and around his leg, so if he had a heart attack inside, then they could pull him out. And at that moment of the death of Jesus, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Not bottom to top as if we opened the access, but top to bottom, God was tearing open the access. I heard a couple of years ago, remember the story? It was before the war on terror, before September 11, when burglars and terrorists used to be able to do what they wanted. And so it was a burglar broke into Buckingham Palace. Remember that? And got all the way through into the Queen's bedroom. And I don't know where Prince Philip was, but the Queen was there on her own in bed. And this burglar comes in at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, good morning, Your Majesty. And the Queen has to entertain this guy with light conversation until she could kind of eventually hand around and get her hand on the burglar alarm and click it. And then the security people came and we had a big inquest. And that's our picture of getting access to important people. They're inaccessible. It's impossible. It's really difficult. But at the moment of the death of Jesus, God's bedroom curtain is torn wide open. You and I can walk right into the bedroom of God, sit on the end of his bed and talk to him. Why? Not because of anything to do with us, but because Jesus' blood was shed in our place. Because Jesus has taken the wrath of God, the anger of God in our place, God has flung the access open wide. And so what will I do? How will I react? When Jesus died, abandoned by his Father, to open up this access way for us to God, there's all sorts of reactions, some mocked. Professional thug soldiers playing a cruel game of blind man's buff. Jesus is the victim. Put a crown of thorn around his neck. Mock purple robe on him. Taunt him. Ha ha ha. Who hit you? Ha ha ha. Smash. Who hit you? Smash. But it wasn't just the soldiers. It was the religious leaders and the crowds as well. So I'll give you they crucified 27, two robbers with him. One on his right, one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads. You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days? I mean, that's a cruel twist, isn't it? The temple was the place where God met people, where people met God. When Jesus talks about the temple, he's saying, I'm the new place where people meet God, and I'm going to be destroyed, and I'm going to rise again on Easter Sunday. And so they've twisted and they've misquoted something Jesus said, and they're slapping him across the face with it. They're mocking him. And these scoffers' words, where they're meaning to put him down, it's ironically, strangely true, because he will rise again on Easter Sunday. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, but can't save himself. No, 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 no. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe. And those crucified with him heaped insults also. And the irony here is amazing. Of course Jesus could have saved himself. Of course he could. He's God's king on the planet. But rather than save himself, he chooses to save others, and he can't save me without himself going to the cross. But today it is exactly the same. There are people who mock, religious leaders who mock the death of Jesus, and crowds who mock the death of Jesus. I've been watching closely the Hillsong controversy. You've been following the Hillsong controversy in the Herald this week? I've been watching it closely. We haven't got a lot of time. I'm not going to go, and it's totally off the topic of where we're going today, but there's this controversy about the Mercy Ministries and whether or not they've done the right thing, and I've got some very strong views, and I'm not going to go anywhere near there, but I read the opinion blog in the Herald on Monday, and all hundreds of people had commented, and they ripped into Hillsong, and they ripped into Mercy Ministries, and then they ripped into all religion, and then they ripped into Jesus, and then they ripped into Easter. And I was thinking, that's got nothing to do with the story. And it's just you being a mocker. and you being a put-a-downer. And any opportunity that I can take to mock, to knock, to... I mean, you read Mike Carlton on the back of section 2 of the Herald. And any opportunity that he can take to tear into Philip Jensen and the cathedral here, to tear into Christ, he will take it. And whether or not people are as articulate as Carlton, there are people across our city who mock and knock and scorn like that. But that is not every reaction to Jesus. That is not every reaction to his death. Significantly, there was one very, very different reaction. And at the moment of his death, when the centurion, I'm in 39, who stood there in front of Jesus, heard his cry, and saw how he died, he said, "Surely this man was the Son of God." I take it what has happened is this centurion standing there has seen the transcendent. Has seen, I mean, maybe he's seen, he's used to seeing people die by execution. That's his job. He's used to seeing, I mean, when you die of crucifixion, you die of exhaustion. And maybe he's seen the composure of Jesus. I don't know what he's seen. But somehow he's put together that something is happening here that is much more significant than your average criminal's death. And there's not a hint of mock in his tone. And he stands, "Surely this man was the Son of God." I don't know if this centurion knew that he was watching the most important moment in world history. I don't know if this man knew he'd become the most famous centurion in world history. But there is a deep irony, isn't it, where the Jewish leaders got it wrong, where the crowds got it wrong, where everybody got it wrong. A Roman centurion got it right. And there's an absolutely fundamental point being made here, and this might be helpful to you. The key to right standing before God is not religious pedigree. The key to right standing before God is having a right view of who Jesus is and a right view of what happened at his death. And the challenge for every one of us here this Easter is not to be a mocker, but the challenge to every one of us this Easter is to walk out of here saying, "I know who Jesus is. Truly he is the Son of God." And to walk out of here knowing why he died, that he was abandoned by his Father so that I might walk right into the temple and have relationship with God. But actually, I'd also want to raise this afternoon that, I mean, and you could be here, and you might be thinking, "Well, Dominic, that's all fine. I'm going to do that course. I'd like to do that course. I need to do that course. I can see that. But I actually want to close with God today. I want to fix things with God today. I've been abandoning Jesus. I've been away from Jesus. I've been absent from him. I've failed God's standard, and I can see that God did something very significant for me at Easter. And I want to fix and I want to respond." And the way to do that is by speaking to God in prayer, the kind of prayer that you'd pray. It's the kind of one on the screen here, on the sheet you've got. "I'm sorry, God, I've been a mocker, like the crowds and the religious leaders. Thanks that Jesus didn't save himself, but saved me instead. Thanks that he died to take the punishment that I deserved. And please help me not to underestimate or mock, but to treat Jesus properly as who he really is, my Lord." Now, for the person or persons who are here today who that's where you're at, I'm going to lead us in praying that prayer. And if this is you, you might join me. Close your eyes, speak to God in prayer. Just do it quietly in your own heart. I'll say it aloud, and you can pray with me now. And if you'd like to pray with us, let's say that to God. "Dear God, I'm sorry I've been a mocker, like the crowds and the religious leaders. Thank you that Jesus didn't save himself, but saved me instead. Thank you that he died to take the punishment I deserved. Please help me from now on not to underestimate or mock, but to treat Jesus properly as who he really is, my Lord. Amen. Friend, if you prayed that prayer, and you know that whatever else was going on in anyone else's heart, whatever else was going on in anyone else's heart, you were coming to God. You were walking through the curtain into the very bedroom of God. You're sitting on the end of his bed in relationship with him, in peaceful relationship with him, speaking to him, because the curtain's been flung open by the death of Jesus. Well, I want to say that is fantastic, and you are home. And that is marvellous. That is just the best, that is the most wonderful thing that could happen to you at Easter time. And can I just say on that feedback form, just write on there, I prayed with you, Dominic, and Russ, or Amelie, or Janet, or Peter, or somebody from the City Bible, we'll give you a ring, and we'll help you to make it forward in relationship with God. Thank you for listening to me today. I'm looking forward to next week. I'll hand back to Russell to close.
Thanks, Dominic. Next week, we will continue the series of A Seduction in the City, and it will be City Seduction and Money. So we definitely will want to welcome you back next week if you can come along. But before you leave, also at the top of the response card, if you would be interested in the course that goes along with the Christ Files DVD series, we will actually be doing that here on Mondays, starting on the 31st of March. And it'll be the same time. We'll be in here on Mondays. Craig Jostling will actually be running the course. It is free. We're not going to be charging for the course, but we'll be going through the four-part series of the DVD, and you're welcome to come along and join us for lunch. That would be great. And also, we do have today the DVDs, also books and things like that. John Dixon's books that are on sale are also available to you. So thanks again. We hope that you have a wonderful Easter holiday, and we hope to see you back next week. Thanks.